Welcome to Western Voices. I'm John Young of European Americans United. I apologize for the tardiness of this program because it took longer than expected to research, and also for its length. But when you're done listening, I hope you'll find it was worth the wait and the time, because it will help put a finer edge on your understanding of the interrelated nature of the problems faced by European Americans today, so we can fine-tune our issue advocacy for maximum effectiveness. Our gardens are in and the kids are out of school. The weather is warm and we look forward to swimming at the beach or pool, walking in parks, and taking picnics on blankets in the backyard. We take vacations and reunite with friends and family that are seldom seen often enough. Our spirits are high and our guards are down, especially since during summer months those precious few hours that we have for family and friends after working just can't be spent watching our elected officials like hawks. After all, doesn't Congress take the summer off? No, it doesn't. At least, not in the way we would think of it. And neither do the people, organizations, groups, and owned politicians who are hell-bent on the destruction of our borders, our culture, our continuity as a people, and the national sovereignty States. During the lazy days of summer, they conspire to pass unpopular legislation in the middle of the night on Fridays, so it doesn't make the news until their evil has been accomplished. And these are the same forces across America that, without vigilance and possibly even with it, will shove 20 million unassimilable aliens down our throats without ever batting an eyelash. Surely, as Gideon Tucker reported in 1866, no man's life, liberty, or property are safe while the legislature is in session. There is a point of polite conversation where people can agree to disagree without attacking the character or intentions of one's opponent. And certainly, such an approach should apply to communication between people of goodwill, who have the best interests of the people of our nation at heart. After all, there are limits to a person's knowledge, and polite conversation between disagreeing parties can often yield enlightenment and new ways of solving problems. But such rules of politeness only apply when dealing with people with goodwill towards the best interests of our people. When dealing with people who are not of goodwill, and who actually have the destruction of our people as their goal, extending them such a level of courtesy only enables and empowers their agendas. This cannot be permitted. Thus, in order to rip the mask of legitimacy from the forces of chaos and destruction, it is important to point out their evil boldly and clearly so that the ambiguity in which they hide cannot exist. They must be called what they are. Evil. Not the sort of everyday evil like a pickpocket or a carjacker, but the sort of epic evil that starts wars, spreads famine, and wipes entire peoples from the face of the earth. Unlike the pickpocket or carjacker, whose evil is readily discerned and even punished, the apostles of epic evil hide their malicious intent behind other plausible explanations and thereby escape recognition and thus, an essential task in the advancement of social justice is to expose these plausible explanations for what they really are, so their true intentions and the darkness of their hearts is laid bare for all to see without deception. Another complication presented by the apostles of epic evil is the fact that they attract and act through a motley crew of followers who will support them. These followers can almost universally be described as forces of chaos and dissolution. In ordinary times, in a sane society, the people who make up the forces of chaos would be productively and usefully engaged to their benefit and that of society at large. But we do not live in a sane society. Rather, we live at a point in history when apostles of epic evil act with an unrestrained hand to appeal to the worst darkness of the human heart, in order to use these otherwise quite ordinary people to push and realize their own nefarious ends. They appeal to envy, greed, and jealousy, usually minor annoyances, and feed and inflame them until they manifest in a hatred of all that is good, right, and beautiful, just for being good, right, and beautiful. The result is a population of people who could never hope to create a great work of art, but will instead present feces smeared across the Virgin Mary. Their collaborators assist, and pretty soon their so-called art squeezes out uplifting and inspirational beauty and profundity, replacing it with vile crassness and debased images of turpitude that self-appointed elites subject to oohs and ahs. An example of how an otherwise perfectly fine group of people can be used by a corrupted elite is the classic appeal of a free lunch. The apostles of epic evil do not really care about the well-being of the poor or indigent, but they will use the poor and indigent to advance a broad agenda. For example, the so-called Great Society programs that were intended to end poverty have extracted billions of dollars from the pockets of our best and brightest year after year for decades. In fact, since these programs started, enough money has been extracted to make every person who was poor in 1965 a millionaire. But instead of a bunch of once poor millionaires, we have more poor people than ever before. Any rational person who truly had the elimination of poverty as an objective would not allow the endless expenditures of funds in a fashion that actually creates, extends, and incentivizes poverty, while turning welfare programs into traps that are almost impossible to escape. Yet that is exactly what these folks have allowed, funded, and championed. Even the dumbest person on earth knows that if you try a given approach to a goal and you do not succeed, you give up on the old approach and try something new. The fact that the same failed approach continues to be supported by the same people year after year can only be explained by two possibilities. Either they are too stupid to tie their own shoes, or the programs they support actually have a goal other than the one they declare. A good feel for their actual goals can be seen in the implementation of our welfare system and what it achieves in reality. Forget what people say. Look instead at what they accomplish. Maybe, for a year or two, the fact that they are accomplishing something other than their stated goals can be explained away by ignorance or stupidity. But if the same situation prevails for 40 years, ignorance is not an explanation. The only explanation is that what they are accomplishing is what they actually intend to accomplish. In other words, they are acting from malice rather than ignorance or stupidity. Think about this conclusion carefully, because it is important. There can be no doubt that a few misguided but otherwise well-meaning people really believe that the avalanche of alphabet soup coming out of Washington and state capitals really helps people and serves a necessary purpose. And these folks have an excuse. But what about the architects of that system, like Ted Kennedy, or the go-along supporters of that system of both major political parties? Can they truly claim ignorance as an excuse? Absolutely not. The majority of our legislators are lawyers, and as such, they probably performed quite well on the LSAT, a test used to gain admission to law school. The LSAT predominantly tests a person's reasoning ability. The long and short is that our legislators have access to the same facts of reality that you and I do, and it doesn't take the logic of Aristotle to reach the very simple and correct conclusion that I just demonstrated. Thus, you can rest assured that the alphabet soup form of perpetual bureaucracy that has replaced our constitutional republic achieves exactly what its designers intend it to achieve. So, what does it achieve? It creates a pretty much permanent and ever-expanding class of people who are utterly dependent on government for their food, clothing, and shelter. Along with this, it spins off entire self-interested government agencies staffed by personnel whose jobs would be lost if they ever actually solved the problems they are supposed to solve. It also sets up an entire industry of non-profit, non-governmental, and semi-governmental organizations, departments, lobbyists, and advocacy groups, all of which depend ultimately on your wallet for their money, and then turn around and use that money to buy legislators who will perpetuate that system indefinitely. If that isn't a recipe for an infernal device, I can't imagine what is. In a sane society, everyone should be able to provide for his own sustenance. With the exception of the mentally or physically disabled, no person of sound mind and body should be in a position where the money they can earn for an honest day's work won't pay for a roof, clothing, and food. And, for most of American history, that was the case. What little charity was required was accommodated by local communities, religious institutions, and extended families. There was no need for government to step in. Of course, that all ended shortly after our Congress burdened our unsuspecting citizenry with the Federal Reserve Act. During my last broadcast, I covered the Federal Reserve Act and how an inflationary fiat currency and government deficit spending interact with the Social Security system to create an inescapable Ponzi scheme that drives illegal immigration and offshoring. Today, I am going to explain how it creates a dependent welfare class that is easily converted into a force of dissolution commanded by the apostles of epic evil. As you'll recall, the main problem with a fiat currency is that it allows government to spend hundreds of billions of dollars a year without having either current tax revenues or assets to fund the expenditure. This money floods our economy, thus reducing the value of the money already in circulation, including the value of savings. Since 1913, the dollar has lost 96% of its value this way, because the ability to spend money to buy votes and delay the payment indefinitely is an irresistibly powerful drug for our political class. You might also recall me mentioning that numerous things can offset this inflation, including an infinitely expanding population, offshoring to ever cheaper labor sources, and gains in productivity. This latter item, productivity, is where we are going to focus. There are three ways that productivity can be improved in order to offset inflation. You can seek higher quality personnel, improve processes so that existing personnel can produce more work for what they get paid, or pay lower wages for the same work. In terms of economics, they are all pretty much the same thing, and all of these techniques are applied regularly, both individually and in combination. The first approach, seeking higher quality personnel, manifests itself in what I would call qualification creep. Jobs that required a bachelor's degree and 3 years of experience 5 years ago often require a master's degree and 5 years of experience today. Of course, there are limits to this, because once you establish job requirements that only a super genius with no family could possibly fulfill, the person will get expensive, because he or she could just as easily become a doctor, lawyer, or trader on Wall Street. Even worse, people that smart are prime candidates to replace their bosses, a situation that makes a hiring manager uncomfortable. This leads to the use of H-1B visas, outsourcing and offshoring. Outsourcing allows a firm with a multitude of specialists to deal with the company's needs in a way that managers don't find intimidating, while offshoring allows that work to be performed by people at very low wages because class mobility in their home countries is minimal. H-1Bs are even more convenient because you can get highly qualified personnel at below market wages, thus killing two birds with one stone. Recently, a Mumbai-based company was forced to pay $2.4 million in back pay to over 600 underpaid H-1B visa holders in Cambridge, Mass. But most such cases are never found. This is a case of qualification creep combined with lowered wages. Improvements in processes can also help. The problem is that such improvements, other than the incremental, usually require a lot of development capital. The cost of the development capital isn't always attractive compared to the other options. Then, of course, there's the payment of lower wages. At first blush, due to minimum wage laws, it would seem that wages can only go so low, but that isn't true. In certain industries, most notably hospitality and agriculture, the wage is something like $2 an hour already, far below the poverty threshold. Actually, even the regular minimum wage is already well below the poverty threshold. But even so, drive to increase productivity through lowered wages in many areas is a significant market factor due to the pressure of inflation. Adding to this is the fact that many jobs simply cannot be automated in such a way that productivity can be increased substantially. Likewise, these jobs are such that additional education and skills won't increase the productivity either. Offshoring is not an option. The only way to increase productivity is to pay lower wages. Good examples of such jobs are house cleaning at a hotel, preparing fast food for a chain restaurant, and harvesting vegetables. Getting a PhD won't increase your productivity making a bed, and you can't ship that bed to Mexico to have someone else put clean sheets on it cheaper and send it back. The only way to increase productivity substantially in such jobs is to lower the wages. This has to be done at a time when the cost of living is rising, since inflation drives both higher costs and lower wages simultaneously. This creates a problem, because it creates a contradictory and untenable economic situation. A person simply cannot live on minimum wage, and certainly cannot live on even less. Fully half of all European Americans, and an even larger proportion of some ethnic groups, have IQs lower than 100. This means that a huge proportion of the population of this country will never become computer programmers, engineers, doctors, scientists, or whatever the architects of our so-called new economy suggest. You see, not only is IQ a heritable characteristic, but it is a remarkably stable characteristic for each individual that cannot be increased at will by government programs. So figure that at the best of times, not counting the hordes of illegal aliens, our country has a large number of citizens who need decent jobs at livable wages that do not require an IQ high enough to finish college. I am not being a snob here, by the way. Personally, I have been pretty unimpressed with the track records of many people who do quite well on IQ tests. IQ is not a substitute for good character, sound judgment, a strong work ethic, and many other worthwhile traits. In fact, sometimes a high IQ allows a person to hide significant character flaws that would otherwise be evident. So I am not being a judgmental snob on this matter, but rather stating a fact of reality. Half of all our people have IQs lower than 100, no amount of wishful thinking will change that, and these folks need livable wages. All of our folk need livable wages and an economy that provides for that. But under our current system, as I just explained, these are the folks most likely to be squeezed through the lowering of wages combined with increased costs of living. So how does this affect welfare rolls? With the downward pressure on wages, once the amount of money an employer is willing or able to pay for wages is lower than the legal minimum wage, the employer must either import illegal aliens and set up a slave labor sweatshop or send the work offshore if possible. Either way, permanently removing that job from the reach of the average citizen. The unemployment numbers also don't include able-bodied people whose unemployment benefits have run out. So there are actually millions of unemployed people in this country who simply sit on welfare. Entry-level wages suitable for many people are so incredibly low that welfare pays better. According to a Cato Institute study, quote, welfare benefits exceed the amount a recipient could earn in an entry-level job, end quote. In fact, and you may find this surprising, the study found that, quote, In 9 states, welfare pays more than the average first-year salary for a teacher. In 29 states, it pays more than the average starting salary for a secretary. In 47 states, welfare pays more than a janitor earns. Indeed, in the 6 most generous states, benefits exceed the entry-level salary for a computer programmer. End quote. The reference study, true to the pro-business stances typical of its authors, goes on to recommend slashing welfare benefits so that working pays more than welfare. Unfortunately, this point of view is overly simplistic because it fails to look at the problem comprehensively. You see, anyone who has spent any time among chronic welfare families knows 3 things. First, the value of welfare benefits is not enough to let somebody live high on the hog. They live in blighted and crime-ridden areas at best, in substandard housing that is maintained as little as possible by the slumlord. They send their kids to poor-performing schools filled with subpar teachers and delusional administrators. In spite of the occasional stories we hear about welfare families eating filet mignon, the simple fact is that the amount of money allocated for food stamps is about the same as that required by an average family. So folks on welfare are not exactly living it up in high style on the taxpayer's dime. So turn this around a little bit and ask yourself a question. Why is it that in 6 states, the wages for entry-level computer programmers are so low that a new programmer can't even have a welfare standard of living? Why is it that in 47 states, a janitor can't earn enough to even live in substandard, broken-down, and blighted neighborhoods? Why is it that in 29 states, a secretary can't earn enough money to put food on the table? The reason why is the fiat money system combined with government deficits, as I described earlier. The problem is not that welfare pays too much, but that honest work pays too little. There was a time in this country when a forward-thinking janitor could earn enough money to own a small home and raise a family modestly, but due to our corrupted monetary system, this is no longer the case. Second, most folks on welfare aren't scientists or engineers. Most folks have a conception of welfare that attributes a whole host of bad character traits to welfare recipients right off the bat. They are seen as lazy, shiftless, and utterly lacking in positive orientation. If only, say most people, these folks weren't so lazy, they'd be earning plenty of money working for a living. But this isn't true. We've already established that most jobs that can be accomplished by a person of average intelligence actually pay less than being on welfare. Jobs that pay more than welfare nowadays typically require a pretty high IQ, connections, or a relative who works for the parks department in a major city. It used to be, for example, that qualifications for driving a truck were pretty modest. But now, with CDL testing requirements, hazmat certifications, and so forth, your average truck driver is a lot smarter than he used to be. Problem is, that means a lot of people who used to be able to drive a truck can't. Completely separate from issues of IQ, as discussed earlier, a whole host of jobs these days simply don't pay enough to support life. So my point here is that the opportunities available to the average welfare recipient are a lot less than you may think. Third, welfare is set up to destroy incentive for improvement and keep people dependent. I've spoken with a number of European Americans on welfare, all unmarried mothers with anywhere from 1 to 3 young children to care for. What did I learn? I learned that the only jobs they could receive training for were jobs that typically don't include affordable health insurance benefits, and that the minute they become employed to any substantial degree, the Medicaid insurance benefits for their kids would be shut off. What kind of mother would willingly deprive her child of health care? Even for those women who were smart enough to complete college, the state would only pay for certificate programs and how to do manicures and stuff like that, the kind of jobs that don't provide the security for raising a family. They don't receive enough cash from welfare to save up to pay for their own education as, say, an auto mechanic. So they're stuck. Even worse, the system creates a million subtle incentives to subject their kids to the most unhealthy of lifestyles by absolutely excluding the idea of a husband who is the father of the children being gainfully employed. It is a system that kills hope for the current generation and guarantees the next generation the worst possible start in life. So here we have just one example of a pretty much permanent underclass that has been artificially created by our fiat currency system, stripped of hope or opportunity by the design of the apostles of epic evil, and systematically taught that those of us who do not yet share their plight are the actual cause of their plight. The apostles of epic evil then turned this welfare underclass into a force of chaos and dissolution, a voting bloc that is pretty much guaranteed to advance an incredibly detrimental agenda. Moreover, having been taught that you and I are rotten oppressors, who have gained whatever we possess illegitimately, it is not at all unusual for these forces of chaos to feel morally justified and even righteous about stealing our cars, mugging us in alleyways, or selling dope to our kids. Nasty, nasty business. And it all starts with the Federal Reserve System. Fiat money, combined with deficit spending, is the elephant in the room that none of our legislators mention. None but Ron Paul, anyway. It is the engine that drives the need for businesses to move production offshore, import foreign workers, and even open up sweatshops. It is the engine that allows us to buy products made with child slave labor in China without a single pang of conscience, thus devaluing human life for all of us. It is the engine that creates permanent dependent classes who can be used by globalist elites to drive horrific agendas. And it is the engine that not merely drives globalism, but makes it a necessity through its requirement for constant expansion. Speaking of immigration issues, we explored how our monetary policies drive illegal immigration last week. But I'd like to expand on that a bit to tie in illegal immigration with slave labor and welfare. We have laws in this country that, at least in theory, require payment of minimum wages, prevent workplace abuses, disallow slave labor, and so forth. Along with this, even for welfare recipients, we have laws regulating the number of people who can live in a home or apartment with a certain number of bedrooms. Thus, those of us who are citizens of the United States and are bound by its laws, and who also have easy recourse for redress through the law, are constrained to comply. Even if I wanted to, I couldn't move 25 people into a three-bedroom house if those people were citizens who spoke the language, or I did it in suburbia. Pretty soon, there would be complaints to the zoning board. Under those same circumstances, I couldn't get away, for very long, with paying people less than minimum wage, withholding overtime, or enforcing slave labor. But all of that changes if I have an available population of workers who are here illegally and so are understandably hesitant to call officials to complain, or who don't speak English, and even better, aren't even literate in their own language. Such folks, particularly coming from destitute poverty in areas run more by armed gangs than government, are an ideal group ripe for exploitation. Thus, such folks will live and work under conditions that wouldn't even be legal. These are the jobs that Americans don't want. Indeed, these are jobs that are outright illegal to offer or accept. You probably think I'm exaggerating. Unfortunately, I'm not. The conditions under which millions of illegal aliens live and work in the United States today aren't much better than those provided for African slaves in the plantation days. In some respects, they may even be decidedly worse. Looking at just one major newspaper, the Boston Globe, owned by the New York Times, reveals a host of stories of deaths on the job, unsafe work conditions, denial of pay, and other abuses. In September, Two illegal Ecuadorian workers were electrocuted due to unsafe work conditions, one of whom died and the other suffered major burns. According to the story in the Boston Globe, quote, "The plight of the two Ecuadorian workers, who police said were in the country illegally, underscores the difficulties of ensuring the safety of Massachusetts' undocumented workers, a challenge state officials have struggled with in recent years. The most familiar scenario involves unscrupulous employers hiring cheap labor without having proper safety measures in place," end quote. Just before that, a class action suit was brought against Cambridge Health Network for paying illegal immigrants who worked as janitors less than minimum wage, failure to pay overtime, failure to reimburse required expenses, and a host of similar abuses. Just this past March, officials shut down a factory in New Bedford, Mass., that was one of the top 100 defense contractors in the United States. Officials found literal sweatshops conditions. The contractor, Bianco Incorporated, actually helped illegal aliens obtain fraudulent documentation. It was worth it to the company, of course, since they were paid less than minimum wage, denied access to even toilet paper, worked 16 hours a day, and had their pay docked for using the restroom. No kidding. And this is just scratching the surface in one major newspaper. A cursory examination reveals a consistent pattern of such abuse and de facto slavery. Back in 2004, three grocery chains in California paid a $22 million settlement for paying over 2,000 janitors, who were immigrants and largely illegal, $3.50 an hour and refusing to pay them overtime even after they worked 7 days a week. Sweatshops and low pay are just scratching the surface. According to the Human Rights Center at University of California at Berkeley, quote, "Forced labor is a pervasive problem in the United States," end quote. The report describes the phenomenon this way. Quote, "Most are trafficked from 35 or more countries and, through force, fraud, or coercion, find themselves laboring against their will in the United States. Chinese comprise the largest number of victims, followed by Mexican and Vietnamese. Some victims are born and raised in the United States and find themselves pressed into servitude by fraudulent or deceptive means. Over the past 5 years, forced labor operations have been reported in at least 90 U.S. cities. These operations tend to thrive in states with large populations and sizable immigrant communities such as California, Florida, New York, and Texas, all of which are transit routes for international travelers. Forced labor is prevalent in 5 sectors of the U.S. economy: prostitution and sex services, 46%, domestic service, 27%, agriculture, 10%, sweatshop factory, 5%, and restaurant and hotel work, 4%. Forced labor persists in these sectors because of low wages, lack of regulation and monitoring of working conditions, and a high demand for cheap labor. These conditions enable unscrupulous employers and criminal networks to gain virtually complete control over workers' lives." End quote. When El Presidente Jorge Bush talks about jobs that Americans don't want, and we bemoan the jobs that welfare recipients are too lazy to do, these sorts of so-called jobs are what we are really discussing. Let's take it back again to the Federal Reserve System. By forcing infinite expansion, higher prices and lower wages, it creates a lower standard of living. It starts with those folks who are lowest on the socioeconomic ladder and works its way up from there. Because of minimum wage and workplace safety regulations, many of these folks get pushed into more or less permanent welfare and are then held there by a system calculated to assure continued dependency for political reasons. Meanwhile, because those jobs still need to be done, illegal aliens are used to circumvent the regulatory system, often under conditions of slavery or near slavery. In fairness, sweatshops and slave labor were used in this country well before the advent of the Federal Reserve System. There is always a subset of the population who will seek to exploit other human beings as though they are animals. Ideally, a sane society creates safeguards to keep such tendencies in check or redirect them in a non-destructive way. Certainly, welfare in various forms also predates the Federal Reserve System. Ideally, a sane society creates mechanisms to assist its most vulnerable members while keeping a handle on the free rider problem so the society isn't bankrupted. Unfortunately, as I noted earlier, we don't live in a sane society. Instead, we live in a society dominated by competing and cooperating special interests, for whom the best interests of the people of our nation is a far distant concern, if at all. But even though these phenomena have existed in the past, they exist to a far greater degree today because our financial system has stacked the deck to perpetuate it, and our electoral system has become incredibly corrupt so that our legislatures conform to the wishes of the special interest groups that are served by these systems. I'll speak about the electoral system in a future program, but the point for now is that only a corrupted process would allow such travesties of justice and offenses against humanity to continue. Now, let's look at the use of welfare by illegal aliens. We already see that illegal aliens have been brought into the country as an unempowered and disenfranchised slave class to serve special interests. This is driven by inflation caused by government deficit spending combined with a fiat currency and exacerbated by the evil leanings of a subset of people. We also see that welfare rolls are swollen as a result of that same system, creating a permanent underclass. Both of these groups are used as forces of chaos and dissolution by the apostles of epic evil to help secure their own nefarious ends of a global slave plantation. Combined, we are now seeing hordes of illegal aliens using the welfare system to provide their food, health care, and housing. This shifts the burden for their low wages from their employers to the productive citizens. In some states, the average citizen family is paying over $1,100 annually just for the welfare burden represented by illegals. Currently, just at the state level, not counting the federal costs, we are spending $36 billion a year on welfare costs of illegal aliens. This strains the finances of the families of European Americans, putting even more downward pressure on both their wages and birth rates. From what we've discussed so far, it is obvious how diabolical and corrupt our Federal Reserve System is, and how it interacts with illegal immigration and welfare to create an untenable situation that needs serious reform. Now for the good news. Both welfare and illegal immigration serve as safety valves to prop up a Ponzi scheme that is really a house of cards. Right now, since these other avenues are available, politicians can conveniently ignore the elephant in the living room. But what if the safety valves don't exist? What if we keep the pressure on Congress and hold their feet to the fire on the illegal immigration issue so they don't get away with their planned amnesty? Ultimately, they will then have no choice but to address the core structural issue. Right now, our politicians are in a panic. Even folks like Trent Lott, who have traditionally benefited from right-of-center talk radio, are talking about forcing it off the air because the calls coming into Washington on this issue are making politicians afraid to pass amnesty. Some politicians have disconnected their fax machines and allowed their voicemail to fill up so they can't take any more messages. They are on the run and showing their true colors and what they really feel about hearing from their constituents. They are very unhappy about what European Americans United is doing too. EAU is one of a host of organizations really mobilizing the electorate in a way our Congress has never seen before, and they're getting scared. It is now up to you to keep the pressure on. Because shutting down illegal immigration threatens the globalist Ponzi scheme of the apostles of epic evil, the amnesty bill that failed in the Senate a couple of weeks ago is back. Usually, such legislation is dead and not brought back for a year or so, but the special interests see it as so important they aren't about to let it die. For the same reason, we should see its death as a top priority. Killing this bill is crucial for a whole host of reasons, but primarily because doing so will help to ensure the survival of our people as a people. We need to hold the line and force our politicians to confront and fix their buy-now, pay-later schemes that are coming home to roost so they can be held accountable. So no later than Monday, you need to have a physical letter in the mail to both of your senators on this issue. No later than Tuesday, you need to send an email to both of your senators on this issue. And every day this upcoming week, you need to call both of your senators on this issue. Let them know that any form of amnesty is unacceptable and that what the American people want is an enforcement-only bill. Be polite, be firm, and be relentless. Go to www.senate.gov to look up your senator's contact information. Your calls and letters are making a difference. Keep up the pressure today so that our children can have a bright tomorrow. This has been John Young with Western Voices. Thank you for joining me again today.